as I moved aside a sheet of fallen plastic to reveal the actress who played Laura. Had played Laura. She wasn't going to be playing any roles after this one, save, perhaps, after the mortician finished working on her. The role of beautiful corpse. Lizzie's actress had gotten off easy with her broken arm. Laura's actress had a broken neck, and a wide swath of skin had been scraped off the side of her face, exposing muscle and bone. "I'm so sorry," I whispered, and placed the plastic gently back across her body, so none of the remaining guests would accidentally see her and realize what had happened. She wasn't the only casualty. She wasn't even the worst of them. I was trying to convince a weeping man to let go of his boyfriend's hand and move away from a structurally unsound piece of the float when the siren suddenly got much closer, and I turned to see the full Lowryland security team rounding the corner. A knot in my chest let go, allowing me to breathe again. They were here. I wasn't alone anymore. I wasn't alone. A glance at the flower clock next to the gift shop told me that it had been less than 10 minutes since the float collapsed. Felt like it had been so much longer. I straightened, trying to shake off the feeling that time was broken, that something had somehow gone horribly wrong and caused everything to stretch out like taffy. A child was crying. An adult was still screaming. The Lowryland security team was running for the float, while the handlers they brought with them were working to clear the remaining guests away. A hand touched my elbow. I flinched and whipped around. There was Mary, now wearing the uniform of a Fairyland staffer. It made sense. She didn't do it often for fear of attracting the wrong kind of attention from management. But with the chaos around us, no one was going to be pointing fingers at a single unfamiliar face. "Come on," she said, getting a firmer grip on my arm and tugging me backward, toward her, away from the chaos. "You need to stop staring and come on." I looked at her blankly, not resisting but not helping her either. That shock I had been wishing for felt like it was finally setting in. "Yay. What? Why?" "Because people are snapping out of it and they're taking pictures. And you've been behind smoke or behind ghosts until now. But the number of cameras is about to skyrocket, and I can't keep your ugly mug off the news forever." Mary looked at me grimly. "Run, or get outed to the world." I chose run. Mary slung an arm around my shoulders as I hunched slightly forward, trying to give the impression that I was feeling poorly and needed to get to a toilet before I tossed my cookies all over the bloody pavement. People behind us were shouting and clearing the sidewalks, and no one was paying attention to two seemingly uninjured workers. We made it through the employee door and into a quiet stretch of the back lot before my knees went weak and I nearly toppled forward. Mary was there to grab me and keep me from going over. Mostly. She was still sweet 16, and a skinny 16 to boot. I was more than a foot taller and easily 50 pounds heavier. She managed to slow my descent, but in the end, she couldn't keep my knees from hitting the concrete. The crunching sound they made was familiar from 1,000 roller derby practices, and oddly soothing. The world was turning itself merrily upside down. I could still feel pain, and still pay for the choices I made. "Hey." Mary knelt in front of me, brushing my hair away from my eyes. Her own eyes were 1,000 miles of empty highway, a color that wasn't really a color and was more a state of despair. Shouldn't have been soothing. I've been looking at them for almost my entire life. They were something familiar I could cling to. "Stay with me now. Don't go wherever it is you want to go." "I want to go home," I whispered, and my voice had so much in common with little Ginger that it hurt to hear. "You could." "I can't." "I know." Mary offered a small, half-pained smile. "But you're with me now. Breathe. Keep breathing. I'm going to go get you something to bring your blood sugar back up. You should be safe here. Do you feel like you'll be safe here?" I nodded, closing my eyes. Despite the bone-deep weariness that was settling over me now that the adrenaline was leaving my body, I wasn't hurt. I wasn't even scratched unless I wanted to count my aching knees. I was just tired. This was so like what I had trained for, so unlike it at the same time that I didn't have the coping mechanisms I needed. "Okay, I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere." There was the faintest of sounds, like air rushing back into the space where she'd been. And I was alone. I kept my eyes closed, inhaling through my nose and exhaling through my mouth, looking for that quiet core of serenity that Colin had been helping me to find. The fire hadn't been there when I needed it. After so many accidents and one notable save, it's hard to top burning down the big tent while I was still in it for the needlessly dramatic, even if that alone hadn't been enough to save the carnival. The fire hadn't been there. I was learning to speak and losing the ability to scream. That was unnerving on a level that I didn't really have the words for. If turning me into a better sorcerer meant I wasn't going to be able to defend myself, was it really worth it? Did I even want to be a sorcerer? I didn't have a choice about being a magic user. It's in my genes, a gift from a distant grandfather who disappeared long before I was born, and I can't reject it any more than I can change the color of my eyes. But there's a big difference between having a talent and training it in a specific way. If I kept working with Colin, one day his way wouldn't just be the right way. It would be the only way, and I wouldn't understand why I'd ever thought differently. There was only so much of a window for stopping this, and it was getting narrower by the day. Miss West. The voice was Emily's. The fact that it hadn't been accompanied by footsteps was somehow unsurprising. Rout witches aren't heard when they don't want to be. Why am I not surprised to find you in the midst of another crisis? I didn't do it, I said, not opening my eyes. I hadn't done it. The fact that I'd been nearby both times was just a terrible coincidence, wasn't it? I know. I do believe we may need to have a conversation, however, about why you run away whenever it seems your picture might be taken. You can open your eyes, by the way. It's just the two of us. I could hear the smile in her voice. It had teeth. Your little ghost isn't going to be able to come back until I decide to let her. It seemed like a good time to remind her that she's a guest in our home. Crap. I opened my eyes and tilted my head, looking up at her. You knew she was here? I know whenever a ghost steps foot on Lowryland property. Most of them are tourists, even among the guests. You'd be surprised by how many people have ride the Midsummer Night's Scream one last time as their unfinished business. Well, that and the re-entry. I'm not sure why it's the roller coasters that bring back the dead. Maybe it's something about wanting to feel afraid enough to be alive again. Emily shook her head, looking unperturbed by the lack of a clear explanation. I know every time she visits. I just didn't know why she was showing up here. Now I do, and I can find her whenever I want. Right. My stomach sank. After more than 50 years, was I going to be the one who doomed Mary to a Rout Witch's spirit jar? All because I wound up choosing the wrong theme park? Probably didn't have these problems at Disney World. Get up. Emily offered her hand. I took it, letting her pull me to my feet. She looked at me critically. You have blood in your hair and on your collar. That's going to be difficult to get out of the fabric. I'm good with blood. Emily raised an eyebrow. As you say, I'm going to be recommending all damages due to this incident be waived on the cast member level. We don't want to discourage people from playing Good Samaritan when things like this happen, which, God forbid, is sometimes unavoidable. We run a fairly tight ship here. Accidents are still going to slip through. My fingers itched, not with fire, but with the urge to slap her. Princess Laura's face came off on the pavement. I said quietly, this wasn't an accident. This was a tragedy. Ginger was probably still waiting for me to come back. No. No, I couldn't think like that. Ginger's mother was fine. She wasn't one of the people crushed under the bulk of the float. She was fine. She was probably with her daughter right now, helping to get the other children back to their families. Ginger would be the darling of the people looking for a positive human interest story to pluck out of this disaster. The little girl in the Princess Laura dress who'd stepped up and somehow organized her own little nursery school. I was happy to let her have the limelight. She might get something good out of it. All I would get was pain. Of course it's a tragedy, said Emily. What do you take me for? I'm not a monster, Melody. But this park is my world, and it's your world, at least for now. Whether you intend to stay with us forever or not, you need to consider Lowryland in everything you do. Her face, I repeated. Yes. Security is coordinating the EMTs now, and we have fire trucks and engineering en route, ready to remove the float and find out what caused the failure. This is a public relations nightmare. We'll be dealing with the repercussions for a year or more. Disney will laugh all the way to the bank. And you helped. You ran into the danger when there was no reason to. You're a very lucky girl. Emily reached out and took my chin between her thumb and forefinger, looking at me critically. Very lucky. I took a step back when she let me go. It was automatic, unavoidable. She didn't look surprised. Go home, Melody, she said. We're closing early today. And she turned and walked away, leaving me utterly, achingly, alone. Chapter 12. There are a lot of ways to be haunted. Some of them are even good ones, if you're up for it. Mary Dunlavy. Lowryland. Backstage. Walking slow. Mary didn't come back. I stayed where I was for a good 10 minutes, counting the seconds, listening as the sounds outside the wall moved from quick urgency to slow, methodical diligence. They weren't trying to triage the wounded or rescue the trapped anymore. They were trying to evacuate the remaining guests before they began unearthing the dead. The actress who played Laura in the parades would probably be one of the first bodies removed, since she was only covered by a thin sheet of plastic. I couldn't even figure out what part of the float it had been, before everything went to pieces. And Mary didn't come back. When I couldn't put it off any longer, not without risking a return appearance of Emily or, worse, the rest of the employees from my shift, who had all seen me running for the float, I turned and trudged toward the door that would take me into the tunnels. Once I was there, I could walk back to the locker room, change out of my uniform, and get my things. I needed to be out of here. I needed to go home. The tunnels were dim and smelled like boiled laundry. That was a constant. On hot days, they were actually cooler than the rest of Lowryland, thanks to that easy darkness. Someone could have told me there was an entire colony of bogeymen living peacefully under the park, and I would have believed them. Given how I was feeling, I would probably have asked for directions. Tea with a quiet, accepting bogey community was about all I was feeling up for. People hurried past me, none of them stopping to ask how I was or why there was blood in my hair. I couldn't blame them. They all looked about as shaken as I felt, and doubtless with far better reason. At least I'd been trained for this sort of thing. They were ordinary people, going about their ordinary business. And now, here we were. Everything was falling apart. I didn't realize I had turned away from my own locker room until I was standing in the doorway of a nearly identical room, looking blankly at a group of women who were encircling one of their own. The one in the middle was sobbing like her heart was broken. Maybe it was. I took a step back. My heel hit hard against the concrete floor. Several of the women looked around. One was still wearing Princess Lizzie's dress, although she had removed the wig, revealing a clean blonde crew cut. Another, in street clothes, raised a hand and pointed at me. "You," she said. "You were corralling the kids after the parade crash. I saw you." The other women started looking around, murmuring. I spotted Fern at the back of the group. Some of the tension left my spine. She was all right. She was here. I wasn't alone anymore. The Princess Lizzie was looking at me expectantly, clinging to the hand of the woman who had pointed me out. I forced myself to nod and said, "Yeah, that was me. I was working in the gift shop when whatever happened, happened. Please don't ask what went wrong with the float. I don't know. I just knew I had to do something." "Andrea and Marissa," said the princess. "Are they all right?" I looked at her blankly. She looked back, impatient, until she realized that I wasn't being dense. I didn't know who she meant. "They play Laura and Lizzie on the float," she said. "Marissa borrowed my wig." There was a wealth of concern in that sentence, making it clear that she wasn't just asking after her misplaced possession. She was asking after her friends, the way I would have asked after Fern or Megan if I thought they'd been in the path of danger. The fact that she didn't have the words to frame her question didn't change the size of it, or its terrible weight. "Oh," I breathed. The room held its breath. "Marissa plays Lizzie?" She nodded. I'm pretty sure she has a broken arm, so they're probably taking her to the hospital. She didn't look like she had any other injuries. She was thrown clear when it went down. Please don't ask about Andrea. Please, please don't ask. What about Andrea? Asked another princess. Damn it. I'm sorry, I said. The whole group stared at me for a frozen second before they began to wail and keen. It was an unearthly sound, too alien to have come from human throats. I took a step backward, suddenly afraid that they were going to blame me for the whole incident. Come on. Fern was at my elbow in eerie parody of Mary's earlier appearance. She had managed to change out of her velvet gown while the other princesses were interrogating me, and had stuffed it into a garment bag over her arm. The makeup still smeared on her face was generic enough that no one who saw us would peg her immediately for a fleeing Princess Aspen. Her eyes were wide. She looked worried. I shared the same sentiment. Not trusting my voice and not wanting to attract more attention from the grieving gaggle of actresses, I nodded and took another step back before I turned and fled, alongside Fern, into the relative safety of the tunnel system. Anyone we encountered here would be as focused on getting out of Lowryland as we were. Fern knew me well enough to see how upset I was, and didn't say anything as we walked toward the locker room where my own clothes waited. I flexed my fingers reflexively, chasing away a heat that wasn't there. It's not that I enjoyed setting things unpredictably on fire, I didn't. It's just that it was familiar, something I had grown accustomed to dealing with, and I missed it now that it was gone, the way I sometimes missed a really bad bruise after it had finally finished healing. Yes, a bruise is a bad thing to have. There's still something soothing about poking it. When the door to my locker room came into view ahead of us, I stopped, turning to Fern. This was the second time something awful had happened while I was right there. Yeah, said Fern softly. We need to talk. She winced, and I knew I was on the right track. Yeah, she said again. Okay. I nodded, satisfied with that answer, and the two of us walked the rest of the way to the locker room, where all the other employees from my shift appeared to have already come and gone. The air smelled of sweat and hairspray, and while no one would be foolish enough to damage Lowry property, not if they wanted to keep their jobs, there was a distinct aura of "we grabbed and ran" about the place, some indefinable quality to the slammed lockers and off-kilter benches that spoke of swift abandonment. Fern followed me to my locker, where I stripped out of my smoke-scented, blood-stained uniform. Each piece was like a weight being lifted off my shoulders, taking a slice of the accident away with it. The smell still lingered in my hair. A quick shampoo would deal with that, and I would smell like strawberries and artificial cotton candy instead of a disaster. I couldn't wait. It wasn't until I tugged my shirt on and reached for my jeans that Fern spoke. "Please don't be mad at me," she said. I gave her a sidelong look. "Did you do something I should be mad about?" "Yes," she said. "No, I don't know, but even if I did, please don't be mad. You're my best friend. I don't want you to be mad at me." I paused. There were tears in her eyes, heavy and threatening to fall. She looked small and scared and very young, almost as young as she had on the day I'd joined the Slasher Chicks, when she'd looked at me and seen one more human to stand between her and the rest of the world. I hadn't seen her smile until the day when I'd asked, in my usual sledgehammer way, whether she knew what a sylph was. She'd been sticking to me like glue ever since, going where I went, doing what I did, being my friend. "Are you the reason I'm in Florida?" I asked, keeping my tone light. She shook her head. "No," she said, "but you're probably the reason I'm here." I quickly looked around. Lowry always said they didn't have cameras or listening devices in the locker rooms, and enough of us were trained to tattle that it made sense the way people who shoplifted or actually violated Lowry policy always seemed to get caught the second they stepped backstage. That didn't prove the cameras weren't there. They could easily be hidden behind the mirrors or built into the walls. We weren't safe. "Later," I said. Fern nodded. "I already called for a ride." "A ride?" I frowned. "Megan's still on shift, isn't she?" "I didn't call Megan." Fern looked at me earnestly. "Will you come? I can explain everything, if you'll come." We lived together. We worked together. Even so, it was surprising how often we were apart. Our shifts didn't always coincide. Now that I was training with Colin, I was often out in the mornings, and even before that, there had been a lot of days when I'd get home, and Fern would be off doing something else, something outside the house that didn't involve me. I'd never asked, because I hadn't wanted to pry. Maybe I should have pried. "I'll come," I said, and finished getting dressed in silence, running a brush through my hair to chase the worst of the smoky smell away before I stuffed my costume into my backpack for washing and turned to face Fern. "I'm ready," I said. She nodded and stood and led me out of Lowryland. The tunnels ran all the way back to the employee lot, and beneath it, keeping workers safe during tropical storms and hurricanes, as long as they didn't flood anyway. If the tunnels ever lost structural integrity, we could find ourselves with a whole new set of problems. Fern led the way, her hair pale enough to almost serve as a flag through the dim-lit underground space, and I followed, too weary and beat down to question what I was doing. She would lead me to safety, or she would lead me to my doom. Either way, I wouldn't stop seeing the dead Princess Laura sprawled in the middle of the Lowryland street. Being a theme park princess doesn't come with special powers. It doesn't even come with special privileges if Fern was anything to go by. They're people in pretty dresses, trying to be a huggable face for a beloved childhood character. And no one cares that those dresses weren't designed to be worn in the Florida heat, or that there are really 10 people wearing that same costume over the course of the day, in parades, meet and greets, waiting backstage for the current title holder to go on break. The tiara isn't magic. It still felt wrong for one of the princesses to die on duty, like a compact had been broken. Fern walked past the doors we usually use to exit for the tram stops or the train, until we were heading down a narrow stretch of tunnel that I'd never seen before. The ceiling was dismayingly low, and the walls smelled of rust. I paused, frowning, and looked back. Yep, the light was definitely dimmer here. "Fern, it's okay. These are still official tunnels. They just don't get used much since the tram went in. People used to have to walk all the way to the train whenever they wanted to go home. Can you imagine?" It felt like we were walking all the way to the train. "Yes," I said flatly. Then I paused. "Wait, didn't they move the train station when they put the trams in?" "They did," said Fern, and pushed open a narrow, unmarked door, revealing a slice of Florida sky. It was still light, but it wouldn't be for much longer. The sun was riding low, casting everything in that shade of gold that hundreds of horror movies set in Middle America have conditioned me to think of as the color of the apocalypse. There was a car idling next to the sidewalk, a sort of hefty American muscle car that looked like it could drive through a wall and not really notice. It was painted avocado green, which had to be intended as ironic, since I refused to believe there had ever been a time when someone would find that attractive. Fern trotted toward it, leaving me with no choice but to follow if I wanted all of this to start making sense. The window rolled down as we approached, and a familiar face appeared in the opening. She looked a lot like Fern, but with the color balance adjusted until she seemed less like she had spent the last 20 years hiding in a basement from the terror of the sun. Her skin was slightly less pale, accented both by a spray of freckles across the nose and the sort of artful smoky eye that has no business existing outside of a music video. Her hair was dark blonde, and her smile was achingly sad, like she'd been waiting for this moment for a while. "Hi," said Celia. "You might as well get in." I stared. Here is a thing I have learned after spending my life surrounded by ghosts and talking mice and the ever-present threat that some people my great-great-grandparents pissed off will show up and go all Montagues and Capulets on my ass. There is no such thing as a coincidence. Things that look coincidental are almost always tricks or traps or some combination of the two. When Celia told me to get in, I took a big step backward, wishing I had a weapon, wishing I hadn't allowed Colin to extinguish the fire in my fingers, wishing I had anything that could help me out of this. "You're here," I said.
"Yes," said Celia.
"You're in Florida?"
"Yes," said Celia again,
and looked at me with a mixture of fondness and frustration.
"Do you really want to do this on the sidewalk?"
I did not.
Then again, I didn't really want to do it anywhere. I wanted to return this entire day to the factory and get a replacement. One with less fire and screaming and unexpected death. No, I admitted sullenly. Then get in the car and we'll do this at the warehouse. Celia Mackey, captain of the Wilsonville Rose Petals, shook her head. I haven't killed you up until now. Why would I start? There are so many reasons I can't even list them all. I muttered darkly and got into the back. A car this old wouldn't have child locks, and if I was going to bail while the car was in motion, I preferred to do it out the back, where I'd have more opportunity to roll away before she could swerve to hit me. Celia sighed as Fern got into the front passenger seat. Were you this suspicious of Fern? No, I admitted, after a lengthy pause. Maybe you should have been. She's from Portland, too, after all. Wasn't it a big coincidence that she wound up here right about the same time you did? Celia hit the gas. The big muscle car rumbled to life, waking like the beast it was, and rolled down the street. The air conditioning doesn't work, but you won't be able to hear a damn thing we say if you roll down the windows. It's your call. Right. This was getting confusing. I didn't like it. Nice car, isn't it? Bought it on Craigslist the day I hit town. Well, bought most of it. Poor thing didn't run. It was missing an ultra-rare engine piece that hasn't been manufactured since the dawn of the dinosaurs, and it was basically just sucking down garage space for this kid who'd inherited it from his grandfather. And wouldn't you know it, some collector who didn't know what he had put that same engine piece on eBay the very next day. Celia laughed, less amused than keeping up appearances. Funny how the world works sometimes. Yeah, I said. Funny. Celia Mackey, roller derby captain, personal assistant, of the sort who does all their work over the phone and via email, which meant that her job, at least, could come with her to Florida, and Jink, which meant she could be ally, threat, or both at the same time. The Jink is a hominid cryptid of unknown evolutionary origin. We know they're closely related to the Mara, and that's about where our cheat sheets run out. We know that my honorary Uncle Al in Vegas is a Jink, which is why my family's scant available information is viewed as being incredibly detailed and complete by people who don't have access to an actual Jink. Like many of the more human-appearing cryptids, they've survived through secrecy, isolation, and luck. In the case of the Jinx, that luck has been more active than it's been for most, because Jinx manipulate luck. No one's sure how they do it, and that includes the Jinx themselves, who usually describe the process by shrugging, waving their hands, and asking pointed questions like, how do you breathe? And what is the process by which your body turns food into energy? In short, it's inborn and indescribable. And after my training with Colin, I had a lot more sympathy for that sort of thing. I couldn't explain the exact mechanism by which I'd been setting things on fire, and now that I wasn't doing it anymore, I couldn't explain the exact thing that had caused me to stop. The trouble is, when I set something on fire, I wasn't removing fire from somewhere else in the world. Fire was an infinitely expanding resource. The same can't be said for luck. When a Jink tweaks their own luck to be better, there's always bad luck down the line. If that same Jink tries to stave off the consequences of their own actions by stealing good luck from someone else, that person will get to enjoy all the karmic balancing of something they never did in the first place. Celia met my eyes in the rearview mirror and said with perfect calm, I didn't. Didn't what? Her laugh was low, throaty, and bitter. Don't, okay? I've been a Jink my whole life, and I've been around humans my whole life, and I've seen the way people look at me when they think I'm getting something I don't deserve. If your luck's too good, everyone thinks you stole it. If your luck's too bad, everyone thinks you earned it. So don't. I didn't steal your luck. I'm not the reason you're here, but you're the reason I'm here. So if you could stop looking at me like that, I'd really appreciate it. I blinked, sinking back in my seat. I wasn't, I said, and my voice sounded weak and unsure to my own ears, and I had no idea where we were going, but I knew it was going to be a long drive. It was clear Celia knew Lakeland from the way she drove. Not with the brash aggression of a tourist or the timidity of a newcomer, but with the calm, assertive speed of someone who'd memorized the location of the speed traps and dangerous intersections. Her great beast of a car cornered like a dream, which was impressive in and of itself given how big the thing was. The fact that it was ugly couldn't possibly have impacted its speed, but it felt like it should have. Like anything this hideous should have crept along, not raced. In short order, the lights of Lowryland were so far behind us that they were barely a smudge on the horizon, and Celia was pulling into an unfamiliar parking lot in front of a building that was equally unfamiliar, but still felt like coming home. It was a big warehouse, the sort that made sense when America did all its own manufacturing, the sort that have been sitting empty or finding new uses over the last 30 years. Some of them turn into storage or office space or live-work lofts. Some of them wind up in the hands of dragons looking for a place to start a nest, or filled with communities of mixed cryptids who'd rather shut the doors with humanity on the outside for a change. And some of them, the ones that are too oddly shaped or awkwardly located to be good for anything else, wind up getting turned into roller derby venues. A banner stretched across the front of the structure informed anyone who drove by that this was the home of the Lakeland Ladies. A smaller banner underneath gave their website and suggested roller derby would make a fun night out for the family looking for something to do after they'd exhausted the joys of licensed theme parks. The thought of some of the families I saw wandering through Lowryland, stopping in for a night of roller derby, was almost enough to bring a smile to my face. "There's no practice tonight, but I have a key," said Celia, parking right in front of the warehouse. "Either of you got your skates?" "No," I said, as, "Yes," said Fern. I turned to look at her. She shrugged, sheepish. "I always have my skates, and I usually have yours too, just in case," she said. "I hoped you'd want to skate tonight." "Thanks," I said. The word wasn't enough. The thought of a real track under my wheels was intensely appealing, enough to make my eyes burn with the beginning of tears. I was so tired. Having something normal would be, it would be the world. But it wouldn't change the fact that Celia was here and shouldn't have been. I gave her a sidelong look. "How come you have a key?" "This area is technically zoned as residential. There are two crappy little apartments above the warehouse, and as long as they're being rented, the space we use for our track is a really big community room, and we don't get torn down by the people who think we're making a mockery of the tourist trade. Right now, I'm renting one of the apartments." Celia's smile was quick and wry. "I've gone from team captain to alternate junior jammer, but hey, at least I have a place to sleep. Sometimes life works out like that. Especially for people who can influence probability," I said, and promptly regretted it. Celia shrugged. "May work with what we have," she said, and unlocked the door, slipping through it into the dark warehouse on the other side. Oh, even the smell of Lakeland Ladies Warehouse was familiar. Sweat and wood oil and WD-40 and bleach and dried beer. I paused at the threshold to take a deep breath, allowing my spine to straighten. Aromatherapy works. It's just that not everyone finds lavender and roses to be the most soothing things the universe has to offer. Some of us have a different definition of smells like home. There was a clunking sound, and the high overhead lights began flickering on in stages, staggered to reduce their draw on the local power grid. I stayed where I was, watching the familiar, unfamiliar landscape reveal itself one piece at a time. There was the track. Polished wood flat against the ground, more than half-cupped by the bleachers, which were all on rollers in case they needed to be moved in a hurry. The rest of the trackside space was reserved for standing room tickets, which cost less and kept the space fluid. There were the closed-up food stalls, probably connected to a makeshift kitchen, where snacks and beer would be peddled during the games themselves. And yes, there was the almost obligate disco ball, dangling from the ceiling like an invitation to better times ahead. Celia walked back to where Fern and I waited and offered me a slightly off-kilter smile, asking, "Are you done being suspicious? Can I get a hug?" "No, and yes," I said, and hugged her. "I have no idea why you're here, but it's good to see you.
She's here because of me, said Fern. I let Celia go and turned, blinking.
Excuse me?
Fern looked uncomfortable but held her ground, looking at me levelly as she said, After you went away, I asked Elsie if she'd tell me if anything happened to you. I was so scared and no one would really say where you'd gone, and I wanted to help. If there was any possible way, I wanted to help. You're my best friend.
Okay?
Fern paused. Don't be mad at her, okay? People keep asking me not to be mad. I pinched the bridge of my nose. It's starting to piss me off. Elsie called me when you didn't come home and said you'd run away because the Covenant of St. George was trying to find you and it wasn't safe, and she was sorry but she didn't know where you were and maybe you needed a miracle, said Fern, rapid fire. I lowered my hand and stared at her.
What?
I knew I had to find you. I knew you'd try to do everything alone if I didn't, and I knew you'd get hurt. Probably really, really hurt. You're just human, Annie. You can't save the world without help.
Fern looked at me earnestly. Don't be mad.
But you... How did you find me?
That would be me. Celia raised her left hand. The overhead lights glittered off her wedding ring. She told me what she needed. She needed you to be safe. She needed to be able to be where you were and to be in a position to help. As for me, I needed a change and I had an excess of bad built up. So, I cashed in my chips and moved across the country to help a friend. I've done more for less. An excess of... I caught myself mid-sentence, but not fast enough to see Celia's smile go tight around the edges.
Damn. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Me too, she said. Her hand dropped back down to her side. It was a heart attack. Tav was older than me. Not quite cradle-robbing, but close enough to make some people uncomfortable. That's how it has to be when your species is on the way out the door, you know? You meet somebody you think you could be happy with, and you grab on with both hands, because there's every chance in the world that you're not going to get a second shot at being happy like that. He loved me, God. He loved me. He never let me be the one to spend the luck to keep us safe. He never told me how much he was spending, either. I guess it turned out to be too much, because he was walking out the door heading for work, and then he was gone. Dead before he hit the ground. The sort of big catastrophic failure that ends everything. But he left me his life insurance and no debts, and the memory of being loved by someone who cared so much that he was willing to use his heart as collateral against the future. How do you get mad at somebody like that? You don't.
All of this must have happened after I'd left for the Covenant. I remembered Celia's husband as a smiling figure in the stands on the nights when the slasher chicks had skated against the rose petals. He'd always worn his wife's team colors, proud in pink and glorious in green. And he'd cheered louder than anyone when the rose petals had pulled off a particularly clever bit of skating. I'd never actually met the man, but he'd seemed like a nice guy, and Celia had clearly loved him. Fern looked between us, timid as I'd ever seen her, and said, After Elsie told me you were in trouble, I asked Celia if she could find you, if she could take me where you were. And she said,
I said the luck doesn't work that way because it doesn't, but that I could get us to where we'd be able to do you the most good, even if it used up most of what the world owed me for taking Tav away.
Celia shrugged again, less expansively this time, like she was talking about something easier and more everyday than the death of a spouse.
I twisted, and for the next 3 days every channel I got was showing a Lowry film, even the ones like CNN. And when I threw my map of the USA across the room, fell open to Lakeland. So, I figured we needed to be here. We got here, this place was open, Lowryland needed a Princess Aspen. The luck knew where it wanted us.
How did the Covenant ever find you? I blurted. I felt bad about it immediately, but I didn't try to take the question back.
Celia shook her head. People think we're thieves. People are always happy to tell the authorities about thieves, even when they don't trust the authorities either. I don't steal good luck from people. I can lure free-range luck toward myself, but there are consequences. Look at what happened to Tav.
Yeah, I said uncomfortably.
So, someone told the Covenant, Hey, those people over there? I think they're witches. and one of us got cut open, and someone figured out we weren't absolutely perfectly human, and suddenly we were on the public enemy number one list, along with all the other species whose camouflage was too good. Celia looked at me with cold, flat eyes. I suddenly wondered how much of my situation she knew about, and how much of it she was planning to hold against me. If you look human and you're not human, you're worse than a manticore. At least a manticore isn't going to seduce a good Covenant soldier away from the path of righteousness. My family's human, and we do that all the time, I said weakly. The jury's still out on that, said Celia. Right. We were getting too far afield from the original topic, and I was getting more and more uncomfortable. It was time to get back to basics. Fern, you said we needed to talk when I asked about why bad things kept happening near me, I said. Why? Fern looked at Celia. Celia looked back, raising one eyebrow, and shook her head. Fern sighed and turned back to me. Having watched this little interplay with increasing dubiousness, I asked warily, What? It's aftershocks, said Fern. Of what? Of me spending a whole lot of luck so we'd all wind up in the best possible position, said Celia. I stared at her, slow fury building in my gut. You mean this is... You caused this?
No,
said Celia immediately.
This was going to happen no matter what, just like you were already heading for Florida by the time Fern told me we needed to get you. The accidents have nothing to do with me. But when I bent your luck to put you into proximity of good things, us, that had to be balanced, and the universe is balancing it by putting you into proximity of bad things. It's only because I started with so much good luck that you're winding up close enough to help without getting seriously injured. The aftershocks won't last forever. They're the cascade effect that always follows a major adjustment. And this isn't your fault, and it isn't mine.
Colin could be an aftershock. Having a teacher drop into my lap when I was in a position to learn and leave, rather than being tied to him for the rest of my life, was almost the definition of luck. Still, is this going to cost me anything?
No.
Celia looked at me. I already paid. The blankness in her voice made me want to apologize for the world, for the things I'd never done and would never dream of doing. I swallowed the impulse and asked instead, Do you both skate here? I don't have time to be on a team, and I don't want to skate if you're not skating with me, said Fern. We're the best. Slasher chicks forever.
I don't have that sort of misplaced loyalty, and a girl needs something to do with her free time, said Celia. I've been working on Fern.
I'm an uncrackable fortress, said Fern serenely. I looked at the track. It looked just like every other regulation flat track in the world, smooth and polished and beckoning. And I was so tired, so damn tired. My life kept flipping upside down, and no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't seem to make it stop.
Let's skate, I said.
Fern smiled. The track was smooth as silk beneath my wheels, with none of the cracks or irregularities that could turn skating at Lowryland into the bad kind of adventure. Falling would still hurt, but it would be the good, clean hurt of an impact well-earned, and not the slightly offensive hurt of a fall I shouldn't have taken. It's funny, but pain seems worse when it's unreasonable. When I broke 3 ribs falling from the top of a pyramid during cheer practice, I was totally cool with that. But when I broke an arm falling into one of my own pit traps, I was a lot less sanguine. Fern, as always, skated like it was an excuse to play keep away with the laws of physics. There was no one here to put on a show for, and so she was varying her density as she whipped around the track, bleeding it off when she was on the straight stretches, pulling it on when she was zipping around a corner and needed to keep herself from overbalancing. If I hadn't known what she was doing, I probably wouldn't have jumped directly to density manipulation. But it was easy to tell that she was doing something, which is why she skated straight when we were in the middle of an actual bout. Celia was a better skater in many ways. She knew the track. She knew her body and its capabilities. She was taller than Fern, but when the sylph wasn't tinkering with her mass to gain momentum,
Celia was actually faster because Celia knew how to position her body to reduce wind drag. She'd never been in a position to cheat the way Fern could. Her potential cheating was more of a subtle sort, and she never did it on the track. Luck changing without warning was the way Derby girls got hurt. I fell somewhere between them, skill-wise. I had to work harder than Fern, which meant I had a better idea of the actual techniques a good skater used. I couldn't make myself lighter to avoid a fall, or heavier to keep someone from knocking me over. But Celia had been skating for a lot longer than I had. And once you get past the base levels of a person's natural athleticism, practice is what makes perfect. Back home in Portland, we were both jammers, and she was one of the ones I had to look out for when we were skating against each other. There was no competition on the track tonight. Just three people circling, doing all the stupid and impulsive shit that could get somebody seriously injured during an actual game. I couldn't remember the last time I'd felt this removed from my troubles, or this close to the girl I'd been for most of my life. I missed her, almost as much as I missed my mice and my family, and Sam. There had been a night, after Verity had returned from her first season on Dance or Die, before she'd left for New York, when I'd come downstairs to make myself a midnight sandwich and found her sitting with Alex at the kitchen table, both holding mugs of cocoa, talking quietly. My older siblings had always been closer to each other than they were to me, capable of opening up when they were alone in a way that enthralled and frightened me. I liked being the baby, but there had been times when I wished my parents would decide to have another baby so I could be somebody's Alex. So I could have the kind of friend my siblings seemed to effortlessly be for one another. "I felt like I was forgetting myself," Verity had said, eyes on the marshmallows melting in her cocoa, shoulders hunched. She'd been shorter than me since I was 12, but in that moment, she hadn't looked short. She'd looked small, beaten down and human. For the first time, I'd realized that my sister was as mortal as I was. Alex hadn't said anything. His eyes had darted toward the stairs, and I'd held my breath, willing him not to notice me. Either he hadn't, or he'd decided this was something I should hear, because he still hadn't said anything. He'd just looked back to Verity. "Being Valerie was easy," she'd said, spitting the word out like it was bitter. "All I had to do was dance. Valerie didn't care about anything else, and for me to be her, I had to stop caring, too. It was easy. And it was tempting, and if I'd won..." "You didn't. But if I'd won, I would have kept on being her. Because it was easy. And it was fun, and I wasn't scared. Nothing was trying to eat me. I got to just... exist." Alex had reached across the table then, putting a hand on her wrist and smiling. "Hey," he'd said, "you're always a winner to me. And I like Verity better than Valerie." She had raised her head and smiled back. And I had crept back up the stairs to my room without my midnight snack, but with a head full of things that wouldn't let me go to sleep for hours. Here, now, skating circles with two people I actually trusted, who actually knew me. I finally understood what Verity had been talking about. I was always Antimony Price, and I always would be. I was also Timpani Brown, Covenant recruit, who had wanted nothing more than to kill the monsters that had killed her family, until she'd found a new carnival and fallen halfway in love while she was trying not to fall off the trapeze. And I was Melody West, former cheerleader on the run, current employee of Lowryland, sorcerer in training. Timpani and Melody didn't have to keep track of who they were. They knew who they were, because they were only one person each. I was all three. Under the pressure of remembering who I really was, of holding fast to the core of identity that belonged to me and me alone. It would have been easier if I'd had my mice. Mice never let anybody forget who they really are. We skated, and the world was simple. The trouble was going to come when we had to stop. Chapter 13. Your family, your real family, will always welcome you home with open arms. Anyone who says you can lose their love isn't real family, no matter what blood says. Evelyn Baker. A shitty company apartment 5 miles outside of Lakeland, Florida. Fern and I crept through the apartment door and into the darkened living room sometime after midnight, shoes in our hands, trying to be quiet enough not to wake Megan. We were almost to the hall when a voice spoke from the couch. "Nice to know that you're not dead." We froze, me grimacing, Fern pressing closer to me, like she thought I was going to protect her. Which, let's be honest, I would have happily done if this had been some dangerous monster or supernatural threat. Sadly, it wasn't. It was our roommate, and she did not sound happy. "Hi, Megan," I said weakly, turning toward the voice. I couldn't see her, not even an outline. But I had no doubt that she could see me. Gorgons have excellent night vision. "How was your shift?" 8 fatalities. Fatalities! From an accident inside the park, in the area I know you were working today. The light next to the couch clicked on, revealing Megan. She was glaring behind the smoked lenses of her glasses, and if it had been possible for sheer anger to make her gaze more powerful, I would have been petrified before I had a chance to blink. "You want to tell me where the hell you've been?" Looking at her, even as a friend and ally, it was easy to understand why the Covenant had taken one look at the Gorgons and gone, "We need to kill those in a hurry." The snake surrounding her face had picked up her anger and transformed it into something out of a horror movie, rising until they formed a sort of hood of scales and fangs and potential pain. They were all pulled into striking positions, flattening their heads slightly to make themselves look bigger. I knew Megan didn't have conscious control over what they did, and that was a good thing, because if she had been able to tell them what to do, I would have had to assume she'd ordered them to scare the pants off me. "Skating," said Fern, in a meek voice. She stayed pressed close to my side. She was scared, too. We keep frightening each other. Whether we mean to or not, we just keep frightening each other. "Neither of us was hurt when the float collapsed, but I was right there," I said. "I was technically one of the first responders because I beat the security team and the EMTs to the wounded." Andrea, who had played Laura. Her face gone. Ginger. Parents missing and eyes bright with tears. It messed me up pretty bad. "So, I took her skating," said Fern, picking up the essential shape of the narrative. She stepped forward, putting herself between me and Megan. Scared as she was, she knew I didn't share her immunity to a Gorgon's gaze. "I'm sorry I didn't text. I knew you were working." Megan held her glare for a moment, before thawing and saying, "It's okay. I had my hands full all night. I didn't even really start worrying about you until I got home and you weren't here. Neither of you was hurt." "We're fine," I said. 8 people died? And about 50 were injured. "What happened?" I opened my mouth to reply, and I hesitated. Celia hadn't done this. She said she was innocent, and I believed her. Jinx don't create luck, just move it around. And if she hadn't been spending her luck since reaching Florida, the accident couldn't be her fault. My proximity to it was on her, and it was exactly what I would have asked for if she'd told me this was coming. Because I'd been close, I'd been able to help. Because I'd been able to help, maybe things have been less terrible. "I don't know," I said finally. "I was in the shop when something went bang, and by the time I made it outside, the float was on the ground and people were running everywhere. I don't think it was something somebody did on purpose." "Why not?" "Because..." I hesitated again, this time to review my memory of the crowd. There had been a few people standing, frozen in their shock and terror. But that was normal. Drop an alien monster into a tour group and it'll have plenty to eat, because not everyone will be able to recover in time to run away. Because there wasn't anyone who seemed overly happy about what was happening. It could have been sabotage, I guess, if someone was looking to hurt the company or reduce competition for another theme park. But that seems extreme. I think we'd have seen signs before this. "So what? Mechanical failure?" Megan frowned. "I thought they'd have safeguards against that sort of thing. All the safeguards in the world won't stop something that really wants to break." I rubbed my forehead with one hand. The skating had cleared away the fog, making it easier for me to think. That didn't make any of this comfortable. It doesn't feel like intentional sabotage. It was too big without having any convenient gloating. "That's terrifying." Megan wrapped her arms around herself. "I'd almost rather this be something somebody had done. It's easier to fight a person than an accident, I said. It was hard to stop replaying the scene over and over in my mind. Now that Megan had caused me to knock the mental scab off, it was like all the infection that had built up behind it was leaking out, coating the world in a thin veneer of screams, blood, and burning. There was still no fire in my fingers. I never would have thought I'd miss it this much. It had been with me for so long that it felt like a normal response to trauma or stress. And now that it was gone, I felt almost numb, like something essential had been taken away. I could feel it burning deep down when I forced my attention inward and looked. But it refused to come no matter how hard I called. Part of that might have been the proximity of my roommates. Fern knew about my semi-controlled magic. Megan didn't. Neither of them had actually seen me play Pyromaniac with a touch. It was only reasonable that I'd be holding back in their presence. And I could tell myself that as much as I wanted. Fire still wouldn't come when I was alone, no matter how hard I begged. Because it hadn't come last night, and it hadn't come when it could have helped me. I wasn't an infant anymore, where magic was concerned. My body was forgetting how to scream. "Do you have a shift in the morning?" Fern asked. Megan nodded. "I start at 9, and I'm on the clock until 9 tomorrow night at the absolute earliest. You should probably figure on not seeing me for a few days. That's part of why I decided to sit up tonight. I wanted to know that you were okay."
"I don't have an email from scheduling yet," said Fern.
I glanced at her, startled. I hadn't even thought to check. Then again, I was the one with the cheap phone that was only a phone and couldn't receive anything more complex than a text message. I was used to getting my shift information at the start of the week and not having any updates until the end. The float disaster changed things. The whole park, or at least the Fairyland section, could very well be closed.
"I'm going to go check my email," I said, and took a step toward the hall.
The doorbell rang. All three of us froze. More than three if I counted the sudden stillness of the snakes on Megan's head. With the living room light on, it was impossible to pretend nobody was home. Indeed, the thought had barely managed to form when the doorbell rang again. This time, the person outside leaned into the act, sending the tone belling loud and clear through the apartment. They were going to wake our neighbors if they didn't stop. Megan bolted to her feet and ran for her bedroom, where she kept the wigs. Fern didn't move. Right. I didn't have a weapon, and I didn't have fire in my fingers, and I didn't have a clue. But I didn't want our neighbors reporting us to corporate either. Taking a deep breath, I straightened my spine until it creaked. That helped. I always feel better about walking toward my certain death when I do it with good posture. I shot a reassuring glance at Fern and started for the door, intending to answer it before our unexpected guest could ring the bell a third time. I opened the door. Sam's hand was raised, finger poised to press the bell again. He froze. I froze. We stood together yet apart, two statues staring at each other across a gulf of less than 2 feet. I knew what he was seeing. Sweat-caked hair plastered to my neck and shoulders, tattered second-hand tank top and yoga pants, skin that bore a sheen of sunscreen and the omnipresent glitter that coats everything in Lowryland. The urge to slam the door, run to the shower, and come back when I was presentable was almost overwhelming. And yet he looked at me like I was candy, cake, and Christmas all rolled into one. A girl could get used to being looked at that way. As for me, I was looking at a tall, brown-skinned man of mixed Chinese and European descent, broad-shouldered in that way that comes with spending too much time on the flying trapeze, floppy-haired in front and close-cropped in the back. His ears stuck out a bit too far, and his hands were a bit too big for the rest of his frame. But I liked those things about him. They proved he was real. Actually, I liked everything about him, and had since he'd stopped glowering at me and started smiling instead. He wasn't smiling now. He looked stunned, like he couldn't believe this was actually happening. I understood the sentiment. When we finally started moving again, he was faster. He's always been faster than I am. A blessing of biology, enhanced and improved by training. He closed the distance between us in a single step, his hands coming up to cup the sides of my face, and his lips tasted like bad coffee, diner pie, and terrible decisions. And none of that mattered one damn bit. Sam was here. Sam was kissing me. Everything else, good,
That, or yet to be determined, could wait. The heat coming off of his skin was intense. As a fury, Sam runs hotter than a human man, even when he's in his seemingly human form. It was a comforting piece of proof that this was really him. Enough so